So this is the third talk we've had on chemical potential, so that makes my job both easier and more difficult. I don't have to tell you it's a difficult problem, but I kind of have to tell you something different from the Philippian cafe. So, okay, I'm going to tell you about why it's a difficult problem, which I think the first two speakers already did, and I'm going to tell you about some progress that can be made at small values of chemical potential divided by temperature. So that's the top left-hand corner of the Fehn's diagram. And that's also something which Philippe covered in some detail. Then I'm going to try and tell you about how to apply models in the bottom right-hand corner of the Fehn's diagram. But unfortunately, it's not QCD. It's much simpler NJL model. And I guess hopefully by the time I get to here, I'll have told you everything I know. So then there'll be some time left to tell you things I don't know. So here is the QCD phase diagram. We've seen it quite a few times already. Here is the hot, slightly less dense region. This is the quark-gluon plasma. Down here in the bottom right is the cold, dense region where there are exotic phases of QCD predicted, superconducting phases. And here is the region we're kind of familiar with. Just to orient you, if you stay at temperature equals zero, and this is going to become an important theme in the talk, actually nothing happens as you go along the mu axis between here and here. The pressure along this line is strictly zero, all the way up to what's called the onset here, where we suddenly, the ground state of the system changes from the vacuum to nuclear matter at a chemical potential of roughly the proton mass. So that there's quite a large region of the phase diagram if you stay strictly at temperature of zero where nothing's supposed to be happening. Okay. Well, we've already heard at least twice about the sign problem, so I'll go through it very quickly. If you write the QCD Lagrangian in Euclidean metric, then with a non-zero chemical potential, the gamma phi hermeticity of the Dirac operator no longer holds. That means the path integral measure is not positive definite. When I first came across this or learned about this, I thought it was something to do with fermions and determinants, which are kind of complicated things. It's not. It's simply because introducing a chemical potential breaks time reversal symmetry of the system. You're kind of encouraging the system to develop a time-like component of a current. And when you break time reversal symmetry in Minkowski space, that's breaking the symmetry between I and minus I in Euclidean space, and that's why there's a sign problem. So the bosonic systems have sign problems too. Well, Q is a time-like component of a current. If I introduce this mu term, it's an explicit breaking of Lorentz symmetry. Yeah, but it's distinguishing the plus T direction from the minus T direction. That's what I meant. Yeah. Okay. Okay, let's move on. As we know, if we don't have a positive definite measure, we can't use Monte Carlo important sampling. As we also know, there's a formal solution to the sign problem, which is when you divide up the measure into something which is explicitly real and positive, and you factor off the phase, and the phase can be included as part of the observable. And then you can get real observables as a ratio of two expectation values defined with respect to this measure. And then there's a simple argument to tell you that that's probably not going to be very effective, because if I simply look at what the expectation value of the phase has to be, it's actually the ratio of two partition functions. And then if the system's reasonably well behaved, well, that's the same thing as the exponential of the difference of free energies between the fake system and the true system. If the system's well behaved, that will be an extensive quantity, so therefore, generically, you'd expect this number to be exponentially suppressed as the volume is increased. And since it's getting very, very small, but the Monte Carlo noise is kind of always with us, then at some point the signal-to-noise ratio will become impracticable. So this reweighting technique must always fail in the thermodynamic limit. That's a rather formal argument. I also, one of the themes of my talk, I hope, is going to be we want to think about sign problem in more physical terms. So one way I find helpful to do this is to ask physically what goes wrong if you ignore the sign problem and you use a functional measure which is manifestly real and positive, which actually all bosonic algorithms I know about do, fermion algorithms I know do. Typically it's a determinant of M dagger M. Well, physically what's happening is that the M describes a, let's say, a triplet of quarks. And the M dagger describes a color anti-triplet of conjugate quarks. And physically what goes wrong is that these, you can form bound states of quarks and anti-quarks, which are gauge singlet. But particularly in QCD, those bound states are very light. They're degenerate with the pion. So they're like pions with a non-zero baryon number. So that's a problem. What it means is that the point where interesting things start to happen in the phase diagram of this theory happens, the onset happens with a chemical potential not at the nucleon scale, but at the pion scale. So you get an unphysically early onset of nuclear matter, and what's worse, the nuclear matter that's formed is formed out of bosons, not fermions. So this is clearly completely the wrong description of QCD. There are theories, such as QCD with two colors, where this is actually completely the right description. So those theories can be simulated. So suppose we now attempted to do a calculation with the correct measure, which is the two quark flavors that both in the color triplet representation. The only difference between this measure and this is that this one has a sign problem. And what you can see now is that the sign problem somehow has to stop this early onset of matter at the pion scale and delay it until the nucleon scale. It has to stop something happening. And it's going to do that by subtle cancellations among configurations with different signs. So this is kind of the suspicious thing that actually you expect to happen. This early onset doesn't happen for some mysterious reason. This is what Tom Cohen has called the silver blaze problem. And I guess he's going to tell us a lot more about it in his talk. I just want to show you a couple of approaches to the silver blaze problem. This is a particularly stupid approach which I took with my friends here. We actually tried to simulate through it. We didn't do a simulation of QCD. We did a simulation of a two-color QCD with one flavor of adjoint staggered quark. This is a theory where the determinant is real, but not positive definite. It can be fluctuating sign. And actually, you can see kind of what's happening here. At zero chemical potential, all the eigenvalues of the adjoint staggered operator will lie along some line parallel to the imaginary axis. The point at which they lie is actually this point here is the mass, the quark mass. As you turn on the chemical potential, the eigenvalues come off the axis and start to spread out to form a distribution in the complex plane. Problems start to happen, or the sign of the determinant starts to fluctuate when some of these eigenvalues can become negative, real and negative. In other words, they cross the go through the origin there. And that happens roughly, it's sort of the empirical fact that the width of this distribution increases as the square of the chemical potential. So in other words, problems are going to happen when the square of the chemical potential is of the same order as the quark mass, or in other words, the chemical potential is the same order as the pion mass. If you ignore the sign fluctuations, if you do a hybrid Monte Carlo simulation, which doesn't even ever succeed in changing the sign of the determinant, then at this point, when this distribution gets out to here, you see a fake phase transition to a phase in which the quarks condense in Cooper pairs and form a superfluid phase. Now, strictly speaking, if you have just one flavor of staggered quark, that the condensate is forbidden by the Pauli principle. Strictly speaking, it's only when you have one adjoint quark that the sign problem is there, or you have to, I suppose, have an odd number of them. So if you do a simulation where you keep track of the sign of the determinant, as you do here, first of all, you see the errors get very big very quickly because you're beating against e to the minus v. But secondly, you can also see that this phase transition where the baryon density suddenly rises actually disappears. In other words, the sign problem, the cancellations between the two sectors, the positive determinant sector and the negative determinant sector, are actually somehow stopping the onset to the wrong phase. So that's kind of a brute. Those look like awfully big error bars to me. There's also a more recent approach, which I guess Paul mentioned but didn't highlight in his talk, that you can now, there are now random matrix model solutions which have been generated in the with non-zero chemical potential. Now, one thing that you can calculate with these approaches, as Paul told you, is the distribution of eigenvalues rho. If mu is zero, or if I'm in the quenched approximation, then this rho is always a real function. And what changes, and how you take account of the sign problem in the random matrix approach, is that rho, in general, in the presence of chemical potential, is a complex valued function. So really, it doesn't have a simple interpretation, or can't be interpreted as a simple density because it's a complex thing. But you can still calculate physical observables. Yeah, this kind of Banks-Cachet approach, that formula still holds. So the great triumph of this paper was that they were able to obtain an expression for this complex valued spectral function in closed form. It's some interesting combination of Bessel functions. And the main point is that precisely at the point where the edge of the eigenvalue distribution equals the quark mass, it starts to become highly oscillatory. And you can see that the period of the oscillations, or the wavelength goes as the inverse of the volume, the amplitude of the oscillations is exponentially large in the volume. So here you have an analytic picture of the sign problem where it's happening. So physically, nothing is happening as one is going into this region. But when you calculate an observable like the chiral condensate, you have to have fantastically huge cancellations because of the presence of these oscillations. Okay. Now I'm going to turn my attention to the top left-hand corner of the phase diagram. We'll see whether the sign problem is important up here, but you know, as we all know, so far until quite recently, we've been kind of paddling along the shore here when the great ocean of truth lay before us. People have been making the first tentative steps into the ocean. And the ways in which people have been doing it can be roughly categorized into two forms. You can either analytically continue your way in, either as Philippe showed us yesterday, by simulating with an imaginary chemical potential where you can do the simulation and then analytically continuing back to real. Or you can actually sit on the shoreline and just steadfastly calculate higher and higher terms in a Taylor expansion. The other way of going, going in is by reweighting. And it turns out that reweighting is unusually effective as long as you stay very, very close to the phase line, the phase separation line between the hadronic phase and the plasma phase. Over here, the overlap problem it doesn't seem to be so severe. And this is the method that Fodor and Katz have developed. And I guess they were really brave because they were the first people ever into the sea. So. In our work, I guess we've been trying to get the best of both worlds. We actually started out as reweighters, but we were too scared to calculate the reweighting factor, this ratio of determinants, exactly. That seemed very difficult to us. So we approximated this by its Taylor expansion, and we went to lowest non-trivial order. I should point out that our results appeared as an ITP preprint. What it enabled us to do is to calculate thermodynamic observables and see how they respond to a change in chemical potential. So for instance, on the right here, you can see the chiral susceptibility. The phase transition as such is supposed, or the pseudo-critical point is supposed to be where this peaks. As I increase chemical potential, these are all kind of in lattice units, the peak moves to the left, which shows you that the temperature is going down. This is slightly more interesting. This is the susceptibility of the Polyakov line. In this case, the Polyakov line cares about whether the chemical potential is positive or negative, because physically there's a distinction between filling up your world with quarks and filling up your world with antiquarks. And so it's quite nice that as well as showing the shift of the peak, you also see a splitting between the positive and the negative Polyakov lines, or the quark and the antiquark. So if you stare at those peaks and see how they move as they increase chemical potential, you can kind of believe that you can trace out a critical line. Philippe has already told you how you can estimate the position of the critical line through imaginary chemical potential simulations. And Fodor and Katz can trace out the critical line by seeing where the smallest Li Yang zero hits the axis. And the remarkable thing is that all of these quite different methods all seem to give approximately consistent results for the curvature of the pseudocritical line. Really is quite surprising, or I think everybody was surprised. Already, I think this plot is a little bit out of date. The one Philippe showed is more up to date. It's worth asking the question, so are we beating the sign problem? My guess is that we're not, because you can also do simulations of the theory not with real baryon chemical potential, but with an isospin chemical potential. In other words, where you give the up quark and the down quark equal and opposite chemical potentials. That model has a real determinant and can be simulated directly and exactly with a hybrid Monte Carlo simulation. And John and Don did that simulation, and they also see almost the identical curvature for this critical line. So it seems as if the overlap problem getting out is being addressed by these various different approaches, but the sign problem in this region of the phase diagram doesn't seem to be particularly important or damaging. The physics is very different. The line is the same. Yeah. It's worth just pointing out that this is what happens if you plot the critical line from the lattice simulations on the QCD phase diagram along with data from chemical freezeout at various different heavy ion collisions. Chemical freezeout is when you actually look at the hadron species which are coming out of an ion collision, and you fit the different multiplicities to the Boltzmann-Gibbs distribution, and that gives you a point in the mu t plane. Those fits seem to be remarkably successful. And what it's, I suppose, physically telling you is what the what the world was like when inelastic collisions between hadrons, which changed their chemical identity, actually ceased. So as the fireball cools below here, the hadrons are still scattering up each other, but they're not changing their identity. And I think, slightly unexpectedly, that there appears to be a gap. In other words, the curvature coming out of the lattice simulations is considerably less than the curvature coming from chemical freeze-out. So if you optimistically identify this line with the true phase transition line in the mu t plane, then it would suggest that there's a considerable region of the plane where we are in the hadronic phase, but where interactions between the hadrons in the expanding fireball are still highly inelastic, and hence a very strongly interacting hadronic medium. Of course, what you have to remember is that certainly all the analytic techniques are based on simulations done exactly here. So you could argue it's quite a brave extrapolation. After a while, we got a little bit cautious about reweighting, and we decided we would become Taylor expanders. So we have a Taylor expansion of the free energy in powers of mu over T, and we've developed this expansion now up to the third order. Gavai and Gupta have recently published a paper where they've taken it to fourth non-trivial order. You only get the even powers. So this is what the expansion coefficients look like as functions of temperature. And what that does is you can reconstruct the free energy and its derivatives, and one can actually then plot the equation of state. In other words, this is the difference in pressure divided by t to the fourth in response to an increase of chemical potential, and also the density of quarks. So this is this data can actually be used to, people can test various models of the QGP phase, the quasi-particle models, against this data and kind of fit it, and hopefully then do things like model the hydrodynamic expansion of the fireball more accurately. What you see here is that there's kind of quite a sharply peaked function. This region here, the function is very well fitted by 1 over t squared. In other words, it's the Stefan-Boltzmann behavior you expect of an ideal plasma. Just for amusement, I've plotted nuclear matter density on this plot. With a slightly more interesting observable turns out to be the next derivative of the free energy, which is the susceptibility, so-called. There are two susceptibilities I can think about. I can think about the baryon number or the quark number susceptibility, and also the isospin susceptibility, the change of the free energy with respect to changing isospin chemical potential. And what here you can see, there does seem to be quite a marked difference in behavior. So the horizontal axis here is always temperature. The critical temperature is always at 1. And the different colors correspond to different increasing values of the background chemical potential. So there seems to be quite a sharp increase in the susceptibility around this point here, which indicates that the system is fluctuating quite strongly, or baryon number fluctuations are important, whereas there are no corresponding fluctuations in isospin. This is telling you that in this critical region, up quarks and down quark fluctuations are very strongly correlated. Now, initially, we were quite excited by this, because one way of interpreting increase of fluctuations is that one is approaching a critical point, and at this critical point, that tells you that some mode is becoming massless. It's possible to interpret that as some kind of linear combination of both the chiral order parameter, which we've already seen its susceptibility peaks at the critical point, but then there's this other baryon number susceptibility is also. The baryon charge is also fluctuating. So the massless field at this point could be some linear combination of these two operators. And because we don't expect pions to become massless at the critical point, there is no corresponding peak in the isospin channel. Subsequently, I think we've come to realize that this, although it's an argument we'd like to believe, it's probably a little bit premature, simply because we now have found that our data in the subcritical region here can be remarkably well fitted to a hadron resonance gas almost all the way up to the critical temperature. And in a hadron resonance gas, it seems to be very natural that in the passage from a resonance gas to an ideal Stefan-Boltzmann plasma, that this susceptibility it doesn't necessarily have to be a monotonic function. So a kind of a peak is a perfectly natural thing, even in the absence of a critical singularity. So I would say, I guess being cautious, that our current viewpoint is that we don't have any as yet convincing evidence of a critical singularity building up from these fluctuations. But it's always possible to do more refined work. Finally, I should say a few things about the critical endpoint, although once again, Philippe, I think, gave you a much more up-to-date viewpoint. This is just a snapshot of the various estimates that have appeared from the various different groupings. So the reweighters are able to actually see the endpoint in their simulations. There's no reason why their method won't get all the way out there. And their most recent estimate has the endpoint actually really, you can express what the position of the endpoint as a dimensionless function of mu over t. Because we're doing an analytic approach with our Taylor expansion, we of course can't see a critical singularity. All we can do is estimate where it is, or put a lower bound on where we think it is by estimating where we think the radius of convergence of our Taylor expansion. So we I think published a figure of about 3 for this ratio a while ago. There's a much more recent estimate from Gavai and Gupta of a much smaller value still, 1. These, of course, are lower bounds. And finally, Philippe told you how the imaginary chemical potential approach can estimate this by using this Binda cumulant and seeing where it shows non-Gaussian behavior characteristic of a critical point. This is probably completely the wrong way of presenting Philippe's result. I think completely the right way was given by Philippe 2 days ago. Okay, there's clearly a big discrepancy between the various things. What I should probably say is that all of these simulations so far have been kind of exploratory. We're all, for one thing, using different values of the quark mass. We're also using different actions, and we're also using different volumes. But, as Philippe made very plain, the sensitivity of this position of this endpoint to the quark mass is probably going to be exquisite. And so these are very early days. So I think at the moment, what I should like to say is that these numbers are all completely exploratory and preliminary, but it's by no means clear that this calculation can't be done eventually. Okay. I'd like to move on now from here to over here and talk about some models that can be used to study strongly interacting matter at a large value of the ratio mu over t. So this is kind of inspired by the phenomenological predictions of superconducting ground states in this region. So I'll just have a little cartoon here to remind you what's supposed to go on. The kind of chiral symmetry breaking which we're familiar with in our world, you can actually regard as a pairing between a quark and an antiquark, or a particle and a hole in this kind of simple-minded Dirac C picture. What happens is that you can excite a quark here that costs you energy, but because that actually creates a quark and an antiquark, and because they are strongly attractive in QCD, you can actually get the energy back if these things form a bound state and then condense in the vacuum. And when that happens, the spectrum of one particle excitations rearranges itself, a gap opens up, and this gap is what we call the constituent quark mass. So this is the chirally broken vacuum. The superconducting vacuum is qualitatively very similar, except this time, as well as there being negative energy filled states, there's also a Fermi C, which is positive energy filled states. And this time the pairing instability is not between quarks and antiquarks, but between quarks on opposite sides of the Fermi sphere. Once again, that if there's an attractive interaction between those quarks, they can pair and open up a gap between the highest filled state and the lowest empty state. Except this, the only difference is that this gap tends to get given the symbol delta rather than sigma, but it's just a symbol. Of course, hand in hand with that pairing is the idea that there is a condensate which will break some symmetries of the original Lagrangian and give the resulting ground state interesting properties. So, for instance, there seem to be rather robust arguments now that in the asymptotic limit of very high chemical potential, this ground state breaks the color chiral symmetries and baryon number symmetry down to a much smaller group, which means that the resulting ground state, first of all, breaks a local symmetry, a color symmetry, and that gives us a superconducting ground state in which all of the gluons are gapped. It also breaks the global symmetry, U1, the baryon number. That means that the ground state is superfluid. Finally, the remaining gauge symmetry, which is some which is akin to electromagnetism, all of the quasi-particles, all of the excitations which are charged under this symmetry are also gapped, and that means that the photon of this fellow can travel through the substance without being scattered. So this is a very exotic ground state. It's superconducting, superfluid, and transparent. If you go to the smaller densities which perhaps we have some hope of being realized in the world we live in, the picture is more complicated for several reasons. One is that at some point the Fermi momentum will drop below the strange quark mass, and that means that strange quarks will find it hard to participate in the pairing, and that means that the condensate which can form will actually break the symmetries in a different pattern. In realistic quark matter, which you might expect to find in a compact star, the situation is complicated still further because compact stars are electrically neutral, and that means there are electrons present. And that means that as well as there being having to think about baryon number, I should also really think about a non-zero isospin chemical potential, which can be sizable. This isospin chemical potential set wants to push the Fermi momentum of the down and the up quarks apart, and that will suppress pairing between downs and ups. That puts a strain on all these condensates which can form, and the various ways in which the system can respond to that strain are kind of an active area of speculation, shall I say. What I should say is that the most urgent issue of all, if you're interested in quark matter, is whether we have it or not. Does quark matter form inside compact stars? The only way we'll ever know the answer to that is if we can integrate the Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. And we're only going to be able to do that if we have quantitative knowledge of the equation of state of nuclear matter all the way up from the onset of nuclear matter. So until we can do that, in other words, if we have... it's not just enough, therefore, really to understand either the asymptotic regime or this kind of interesting intermediate regime. You've really got to have quantitative knowledge all the way up. And of course, that's exactly what we don't seem to be able to get in lattice QCD. It's very frustrating. I want to show you results of simpler models in this regime. The model I'm going to look at is very venerable. It's the Nambu-Yonel-Lacinio model. It's a four fermion model. So here's the kinetic term. The interaction R term is a four-point contact term. It's convenient to formulate it in terms of auxiliary scalar fields in this form. And these auxiliary scalars are, you can think of as the sigma and pi mesons. It's got the same global symmetry group as two-flavor QCD. If the coupling constant here is made to be strong enough, then the ground state, zero density and zero temperature, exhibits dynamical chiral symmetry breaking. There's a constituent quark mass sigma, which is much larger than the current quark mass M. There's also the possibility that the model has enough degrees of freedom to be able to form a Cooper pair wave function here, which would break the baryon number symmetry spontaneously if it were to form and give us a superfluid. Because there are no gluons, I obviously can't talk about superconductivity. Why can we do interesting simulations on the lattice of such models? Here are some comments about four fermion theories. First of all, it's possible to study them in 2+1 dimensions. That means it runs on a work, which is good. It also means it has an interacting continuum limit, which is a little bit unexpected, but not desperately relevant. If we insist on running in 3+1 dimensions, because we're interested in the world we live in, then the four fermion model is not a renormalizable theory. It must be considered as a cut-off effective theory, and it turns out that with realistic parameterization, the cutoff is about 700 MeV. It's barely a field theory at all. Well, then you have to deduce new extra terms into the Lagrangian. Yeah. I mean, this isn't the place to discuss the pros and cons of the NGL model. Yeah. Okay. One feature from the perspective of the phase diagram to note is that there is no confinement physics in the NGL model. You could say it had a very small Bang constant if you wanted. What that means is that when we increase the chemical potential, we seem to jump straight from the vacuum into a phase where both chiral symmetry is restored and the baryon density rises from zero at the same point. In other words, we seem to jump straight from the vacuum into relativistic quark matter. There is no sign in any of the simulations that we've done of a nuclear matter phase where chiral symmetry is broken and baryon density is non-zero. Quite possibly, I couldn't comment. Yeah. I mean, yeah. What I'm saying is, I really want to be applying this model to quark matter, and I can't do nuclear matter with this model. Why is it simulable? Well, it's got a real determinant. All theories with real determinants actually have conjugate quarks. And I guess the point is that in conjugate quarks, some of these four fermion models, they're a feature, they're never a bug, they're never a problem. And the reason is that the low density theory, where chiral symmetry is broken, there is a Goldstone, the pion, but it's the diagrams which dominate the pion channel are these rubble sums like this. And these are only available to kosher quark anti-quark pairs. They're not available to the quark conjugate quark pairs. So although conjugate quarks are in this theory, they don't actually affect they don't have any interplay with the chiral symmetry breaking. So let me jump straight into the quark matter phase, the high mu phase of such models. What I want to show you is a little bit of sort of phenomenology. The simplest, most direct thing you can do is simply look at the fermion propagator as a function of momentum and measure its energy as a function of momentum. That's its dispersion relation. What you find if you plot it in a suggestive way is that you actually get a dispersion relation that looks very much like the cartoon I drew earlier. In other words, there are negative energy states below the Fermi edge and positive energy states above, and there is always a favored value of momentum by which the resulting propagator is almost massless, costs you zero energy, and that favored value of momentum is the Fermi momentum. So we seem to have a Fermi surface in these models. Yeah, this is 2+1. If you have a Fermi surface, you can kind of fit it with a generic dispersion relation here. This is a sort of discretized version. There's two parameters you fit with. One is the Fermi momentum, and one is the something called the Fermi velocity, which is the slope of the dispersion relation as you cross the edge. Now, in an uninteracting theory, this is simply the same as the chemical potential, and this is one, the speed of light. In general, for an interacting theory, these parameters can differ slightly from one, and in fact, they can be calculated systematically in something called Fermi liquid theory. And in this case, they can be those Fermi liquid parameters can be calculated systematically in the 1 over nf expansion. It's the rate at which the decay of the Euclidean propagator. Yes. I mean, this is a theological discussion because this is not QCD. I accept what you say, that everyone who ever talks about the NGL model has to say right at the start whether they think they're talking about nucleons or quarks. I'm sticking with quarks, but you know, it's a matter of taste. Slightly more interesting is if I look at mesons. So I'm going to do meson spectroscopy, but I'm similarly going to look at mesons at non-zero momentum. And the point about mesons is that actually there's quite a simple picture you can draw. If you think about a meson, I can actually build a meson from a particle close to the Fermi surface and a hole close to the Fermi surface. And if the meson has a momentum k, that means I can describe the state in terms of two slightly displaced Fermi surfaces. And there are always points where I can choose the particle-hole pair satisfying momentum conservation and costing me zero energy. In other words, there are always zero energy pairs I can excite. And the amount by which... That means that, generically, the meson correlation function is not going to decay exponentially. It's going to decay algebraically with some power, which is some interesting geometric function of the way these Fermi disks overlap. So for large overlap here, it's 1 over x squared in 2 plus 1 dimensions. There's a particularly favored configuration where the momentum is twice the Fermi momentum, and the two Fermi disks just kiss here. This is called the Overhauser instability, so you get slightly slower decay. You only start to see exponential decay when the momenta are such that the Fermi disks are completely separated. So we looked at several different meson channels in this simple theory, and indeed saw algebraic decay. So these different colors here are simply different values of momentum. And it's very difficult to do anything quantitative here, except to say that I've picked out the red points here. This is the favored Overhauser configuration. You can see that the decay looks a good bit slower than the other channels. It's kind of standing out a bit. So this looks like algebraic decay. So it's like free field theory. However, there's one particular channel we've looked at. It's a channel corresponding to a component of a row meson or a vector meson, where the decay actually looks completely different. Notice the difference in the scales here. And the correlators can be very well fit by decaying exponentials. So in other words, for this particular channel, we can measure an energy for each momentum value, and then reconstruct a dispersion relation. When you go through the staggered fermionology to convert the quantum numbers of this thing into continuum quantum numbers, it looks like that. It looks got the same quantum numbers as baryon charge density. And the resulting dispersion relation looks like this. All of these different values of mu, they all seem to fall on the same as I go to longer and longer wavelengths. They seem to fall on a straight line, a phonon-like dispersion relation, a massless vector. The interpretation that we've made is precisely this. This is sound. It's a collective excitation of the system. Vector sound. It's gamma zero. Yeah. It's a baryon charge oscillation. We're claiming it's zero sound, yes. Yes. Yes, it is. So there are, in these cold degenerate systems, there are many different kinds of sound you can think about. The familiar kind of sound with which I am speaking is a fluctuation in a scalar fluctuation in density. That's like a breathing mode of the Fermi surface. It turns out that at very low temperatures, the Landau Fermi liquid theory predicts that there's a different mode, which is more like a distortion of the shape of the Fermi surface. That's called zero sound. And one way of distinguishing them is that this actually propagates with a velocity which strictly has to be greater than the Fermi velocity, whereas this is typically less. So that's our interpretation the claim is then we've seen an interesting collective excitation of the degenerate system through perfectly orthodox lattice spectroscopy. I'd now like to turn to 3+1 dimensions. It's a bit more realistic. This is sort of actually the kind of picture that I should have showed you earlier, I suppose. This is actually a picture of the onset of the quark matter as you increase chemical potential. These red points are the chiral condensate which falls away. The green points are the baryon charge. Now, actually, the actual details of how this transition happens are rather unclear. They would need more work. When people do self-consistent analytic approaches to this model, you find that the order of that phase transition is sensitive to the cutoff procedure. It's a little bit worrying. So I would I don't know. I honestly don't know. No. That's not the case. People have solved this model, admittedly, with different cutoff procedures, and got different orders of the phase transition. It's not universal. I'm not so sure. Remember, I have chosen my lattice parameters to try to reproduce f pi and m pi and a realistic constituent quark mass. No. Well, for me, there is no continuum limit. I mean, this is a cutoff theory. This is with the 700 MeV cutoff. What I want to show you now is an attempt to look for the superfluid condensate, which, remember, is formed from two quarks. You can look for this in exactly the same way that you would look for the chiral condensate in lattice simulations. You simply have to introduce a source term which couples to the condensate wave function, except this time the condensate wave function has a psi-psi coupling and a psi-bar-psi-bar coupling. So if you think about it, it doubles the size of the matrices you have to invert. And just as for doing a chiral symmetry breaking study, you have to do your measurement with non-zero J and then investigate the J goes to zero limit. And the claim is when we do that, we get this blue curve here for the diquark condensate and the J goes to zero limit, which, once again, the situation is not desperately clear in this intermediate region, but as you go deep into the quark matter region, the diquark condensate seems to be there and seems to be non-zero. This blue curve, incidentally, is the area of the Fermi surface in a lattice, the area of the Fermi surface inside the Brillouin zone. And so it's quite a complicated function. It certainly isn't monotonic, and it's striking, I think, that the condensate approximately follows it. Does the baryonic problem follow? Yes, I think it does. I think we did, but I can't remember. The details elude me. I mean, there are always departures because, the point at which with these parameters, the point at which the transition is happening, the Fermi momentum is already more than halfway to the edge of the Brillouin zone, and that's because it's a cutoff theory. The smoking gun for a superfluidity, of course, is not just the order parameter but also the gap. So we can now look at the spectrum of the fermion propagator again. I'll call it the quasi-particle propagator. And here one can see that in contrast to the Fermi liquid behavior I showed you earlier, in this time an energy gap seems to have opened up at the Fermi momentum, at the Fermi, valley of Fermi momentum here, which enables us to estimate the value of delta, the physical gap. The other thing that happens is because the system is no longer time reversal invariant in Euclidean space, this form I fit to, the forwards propagate decaying piece doesn't have to have the same amplitude as the backwards decaying piece. And in fact, you can look at how these two things swap over as you go through the Fermi momentum. So here, what we say is that these are hull states propagating, and here these are particle states. The blue curve here is what we call the amplitude of the anomalous propagator, which seems to peak around about the Fermi surface. You get anomalous propagation when there is particle hole mixing, so it's only there if you have a superfluid state. So what we found, of course we only measured this in one place because it's quite an expensive simulation for us, was that the gap divided by the constituent quark mass is about 15%, which if you use a constituent quark mass of 400 MeV, and it's all very hand-waving, gives us a gap of about 60 MeV. And that's quite comforting because it's exactly in the range of values that the self-consistent phenomenological approaches have been promoting. What I want to sort of go on to comment is that there's been very similar formalism has been applied recently to non-relativistic systems, in other words, non-relativistic four fermion models, and they can be applied either to nuclear effective theory, or perhaps more exotically to cold atomic systems with a tunable scattering length. And I guess you heard a talk from this from Matt earlier in the workshop. These are both non-perturbative problems because in each case there is a large dimensionless parameter, which is kind of I took me a long time to get familiar with because I'm not too familiar with non-relativistic physics, but this large scattering length, the S-wave scattering length. So the product of this with the Fermi momentum is much greater than 1, which makes both of these problems non-perturbative. Another kind of side remark is that, for reasons I went into, it would be nice to introduce an Isaacman chemical potential into these models, or if you're interested in nuclear matter, it would be nice to introduce a pion with finite mass, and in both of those cases that introduces a sign problem, or reintroduces one. How much time are you going to give me, John? Right. It'll have to. Okay. I won't talk about cold quarks and hot glue. So let me go into speculative mode. What's the sign problem telling us? It's probably telling us we're doing the wrong calculation, or we're using the wrong basis to do the calculation in. Anytime you get a sign problem, it's just telling you that if you think about a configuration like a big Feynman diagram, it's just telling you there's big cancellations between all the diagrams. So maybe we shouldn't be using quarks and gluons. Maybe we should be looking for some smart way. I was struck recently by kind of a hint at the way to proceed in a recent paper from this group, Kayanti et al., who've studied a three-dimensional, or who've exploited an electromagnetic duality between scalar QED in three dimensions with a complex scalar field theory, which is not a gauge theory. So there is this is an approximate duality, which becomes exact at second order phase transition. And I guess evidence for this duality, with numerical evidence, has been accumulated in the statement here. But one interesting observation they made was that you can introduce a coupling, a source term here for coupling to the magnetic field in the three-dimensional gauge theory, when you go through the duality, this source term reappears as a chemical potential for the scalar field. So this theory has a sign problem, and this theory doesn't, and yet they have the same partition function. So maybe, in principle, this is an interesting model for this kind of physics. This is a theory of a planar Bose-Einstein condensate. There could well be quite interesting things to find out about this model. Maybe you could do it by simulating this model. I don't know. R2, would you like to comment? Finally, to reiterate this theme, my viewpoint I'm evolving towards is that the sign problem is not an algorithm problem, it's a physics problem, it's there. There's nothing really we can do about it. Can we think about it in physical terms? Well, there are several theories I've listed here which kind of have a family resemblance, and I think they all have a sign problem. One is the theory I showed you earlier. This is the adjoint two-color QCD with single quark flavor. Now, what I believe there is that the superfluid gauge invariant condensate is forbidden by the Pauli principle. The simplest Cooper pairing that I can write down in terms of local fields is actually breaks SU2 to U1, so it would be a superconducting condensate. We've known for many years, I first heard from Bob Sugar, I think, in the Capri conference, and many the repulsive Hubbard model as a microscopic model for cuprates. That has a severe sign problem, which means that you can't really get into the interesting regime where you'd like to have a solution. Technicolor, I don't know actually if we studied this, but Technicolor is a theory of chiral fermions, complex representations. They must have a sign problem if you can formulate it. There's an interesting field theory approach to superconductivity in 2 plus 1 dimensions from Dorian Mavromatos a while ago. I don't know how realistic it's supposed to be or what people think of it these days. But it had this kind of exotic mechanism for inducing superconductivity, giving the photon mass via a mixed Chern-Simons coupling. And it looks great, and let's simulate it. You can't because it's got a sign problem. And then, of course, we have the example of QCD itself. The common theme, it seems to me, is that all of these systems want to be superconductors. And that's really interesting. What I mean by that is that it's a theory where a gauge symmetry is broken by some pairing. So it's fun to conjecture that actually any system where you break a gauge symmetry this way has a sign problem. I don't know. So it's probably a good place to break for coffee. Good news, we're going into the ocean, and the first steps kind of seem to be encouraging, that everybody seems to agree that the critical line is there and can be seen. There's less consensus for very understandable reasons on the critical endpoint, but so far there's no argument, no show-stopping argument to say that ultimately this won't be able to will be able to be calculated. And what clearly has to happen, where have you heard this before? We need to do much better calculations. In particular, we must have a much better approach to the continuum limit. All the calculations that have been done so far have been on very coarse lattice with a cutoff of about 700 MeV. That's a little bit of a worry, because one of the things that we found using an improved staggered fermion action is that the critical quark mass in three-flavor QCD, for distinguishing where the crossover becomes a first-order transition, is about an order of magnitude different from the one you see using unimproved staggered fermions. So there's clearly going to be a lot of the most essential thing, as far as I can see, is to go close to the continuum limit now, rather than try anything else that's clever. There's fun to be had with these four fermion models, and kind of one of the things I hope I convince you of is if you ever could do a simulation at non-zero chemical potential, actually the physics you get out, it's so much easier than doing simulations with non-zero temperature, because you have a long time direction and you can do spectroscopy and you can really get to grips with the excitation spectrum and see interesting things, which I think are still kind of a distant dream for people studying hot field theory. And then finally, oh well, I can't tell you about the gauge series thermosurface, we have to miss it out, but yeah, the side problems here, we're not going to find a smart algorithm. I think we have to find a smart way of readdressing the theory. The final thing I'd like to say is that if you've enjoyed hearing about field theory at non-zero chemical potential, it's an advertisement. If my computer works, then it's here it comes. Then you can hear more about it at a conference in Swansea. The week after the Lattice meeting, so it's a short hop across the Irish Sea, or St. George's Channel, as we like to call it. So Swansea, come and relax after an intensive week of Guinness sampling, and hear more about extreme QCD with this fantastic array of speakers here. Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for that.